Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 8, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our teleforum will discuss politicized federal spending and what to do about it. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to today's call two experts. We're going to hear from each of them for about 5 to 10 minutes in opening remarks, then maybe a little back and forth, and then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be ready with your questions. Our opening speaker will be Daniel Z. Epstein. He is the Executive Director at Cause of Action. He's also the author of an Engage article at the Federalist Society's website on this same topic. He's going to speak for 5 to 10 minutes. Then we'll hear from Dr. John Hudak, who's a fellow, the Governance Studies and Managing Editor at FixGov blog, and he's with the Brookings Institution. With that, Mr. Epstein, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to attempt, my background is as a lawyer for former counsel for the House Oversight Committee. So one of the things we spent a lot of time doing in our investigations of the executive branch is looking at how federal dollars can be politicized. And if anyone remembers former oversight chairman Henry Waxman, he was very involved in showing that the prior administration had the opportunity and in fact did steer federal funds, particularly federal grant funds, to at-risk congressional districts. So the whole topic of political spending and politicized spending is, I think, one that is worth having a conversation both from the political science and public policy perspective as well as the legal perspective, because ultimately we have something that's different in today's state of federal spending than we did several years ago, and that is we have a moratorium on congressional earmarks. So as my organization has launched in a website that's coming out today called executivebranchearmarks.com, we show that, in fact, congressional earmarking, while that may be over, earmarks aren't dead. And so, of course, was of interest to a lot of Hill investigators and lawyers looking at these issues. Now, my organization that I run, we are very interested in how the executive branch spends our dollars, and we're very interested in investigating and, in some cases, litigating against the executive branch for when there are abuses in federal spending. But one piece of evidence that we have looked at seriously was then graduate student John Hudak's dissertation and now a book called Presidential Pork. And I'll let Dr. Hudak talk about that book in a moment. But one of the things that it did that kind of, I think, is important to lawyers who look at these issues is it showed that there is a very real tendency, and it showed this via statistical evidence, for the president to use the federal discretionary grant process for electoral gain. And if you're someone who works on government contracts, well, there's clear remedies to challenging contract decisions that essentially are politicized. But it's not an open, it's not a clear question when it comes to grants. Grants are by, unless they're formula grants, they're by definition discretionary. This applies to cooperative agreements. This also applies to loans and loan guarantees, which is the discussion with the Department of Energy about claims of cronyism and other politicization. But being discretionary, this to any of those who study administrative law, these are things that are likely within the agency's expertise and the agency's discretion, and that aren't normally reviewable by courts. And so we have not only an accountability problem, but we also have a transparency problem. And what I did in this Engage piece that was released by the Federal Society several months ago was really look at, well, if you take this assumption, someone like John Hudak, who says there's data out there that the executive branch has the opportunity to be politicized through the president. Well, what happens when a grant applicant doesn't get an award, even though they believe that they were entitled to it on the basis of merit, but it went to someone who was in a district that may have been at risk or that may have had a member who needed to win more funds for that district in order to get reelection. And so the reality is that there's very limited judicial remedies. And what I looked at was, of course, starting with the Administrative Procedures Act, which is a general statute that will invalidate agency actions that are arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. But the reality is that even under the Administrative Procedures Act, agencies get an enormous amount of deference. And back to the transparency problem, it's very hard to show that federal grant decisions were politicized. My organization, Cause of Action, has spent years looking at the Freedom of Information Act and using FOIA to get information on agencies. But for the most part, how an agency will score an applicant is in large part confidential. It's not subject to FOIA. It's considered a business record or an internal deliberative communication by the agency. And so it's very hard to show if you're a litigant or if you're an oversight lawyer conducting oversight over the executive branch, it's hard to show that in fact there's been politicization or there's been unfair treatment. And so the APA is limited in that sense. There's other forms. If you look in the contract space, there's other potential ways of redressing this problem. One view is to look at a application to a grant program as an implied in fact contract, where the agency can't decide to award the politically deserving applicant versus the one who's the most merit deserving. And there's also the potential for examinations of Bivens, but again, that's challenging because you have to say that there's a property right in terms of a grant application. So judicial remedies are, of course, very limited. And, you know, this is even, I mean, my organization is actually suing the Department of Energy on these types of issues dealing with the loan guarantee program. And, of course, it's an uphill battle. But I think one thing that I'm, of course, curious from the political science expert, and I hope Professor Hudak, Dr. Hudak, discusses this a little bit. I mean, Dr. Hudak came from Vanderbilt University, which is its political science program is very administrative law oriented. In fact, I think a number of the professors there are members of the Administrative Conference of the United States. And I actually just saw that Dr. Hudak has is working on a piece with a law professor on enforcement discretion in presidential electoral politics, which please don't tell me that agencies make decisions over which companies to go after based off the president's priorities, because that would depress me further this week. But I think what becomes a key point of debate, I think, from folks who share my perspective, that we want greater transparency, we want greater accountability, and we want the idea of merit to actually mean something, so that those who are the most politically connected aren't the ones who win out on awards. I think, and I'm interested in hearing your perspective, Dr. Hudak, that it's not clear that just because an agency makes a politicized decision, you know, you might agree with me that there is politicization in the executive branch, but that does not mean by definition that a political decision is not a merit-based one. And I think that's where lawyers and perhaps public policy experts might disagree. Because I think most lawyers look at things like executive orders 13457, a lot of guidance that agencies put out that says that essentially a merit-based decision is one that is based off the highest available scores or the most meritorious applicants, and that by definition, if there's political taint in that decision-making process, it's probably not merit-based. But I think there's a response to that, and there's a series of views that might help us understand what is the ideal state of affairs if we were looking for a remedy to executive branch spending. Anyways, take it away, John.
Sure. Well, thanks for the discussion of my book. I really do appreciate it. And I'll talk a little bit. I'll touch on the points that you made specifically, and then talk a little bit more generally about the complications that can arise in the grants process that, as you said, really make it difficult not just to identify where politicization happens, but then to understand whether that is a problem from a legal perspective, or whether it's actually fairly consistent with the law as laws are written. And so I'll start actually with one of the last things that you mentioned about whether this debate about whether injecting politics into the process of administering grants or deciding on grant awards is itself part of the merits process, or whether it truly is deviating from that. And I'll say, to begin, my research, at least, and a lot of research on this topic, tends to suggest that politicization in the context of discretionary federal grants tends to happen at the margins. And so this is not a minuscule amount of money. It tends to be hundreds of millions of dollars a year, but it does tend to affect between 5% and 10% on average of federal grant spending. It's in some agencies it's more, in some agencies it's less, but it's not as if 50%, 60%, 70% of grant funding is happening in a political manner. It tends to be technocratic. It tends to be merit based in the more traditional sense that we think of merit based allocations of funds. But within that, there are within that remaining 5% to 10%, there are certainly political factors. So having powerful members of Congress representing you either in the House or in the Senate, that helps quite a bit. For a governor to share the same party as the sitting president, that helps. And what my research focuses on predominantly is if you're a swing state, you tend to benefit quite substantially in the receipt of federal grant dollars and federal grants specifically than non-swing states do. And for swing states, it's particularly enjoyable because you don't have to worry about how the political winds are blowing. You know, you can't – Republican states are going to benefit when there are Republican presidents, but swing states are going to benefit no matter who is president, because swing states tend to remain swingy over time, though that there are deviations from that. But Ohio does quite well, and Wisconsin does quite well, and Florida does quite well, whether you have a Republican like President Bush in office or a Democrat like President Obama. And so back to the original point, it's a really important question about whether politicized spending should be part of the merit process. And I think there are certainly people out there from swing states and who would suggest that, you know, that's part of the game of politics, and the law is not necessarily clear on this point. And my answer to that question is I really think it depends on what that grant program looks like. For some grant programs, Congress is extraordinarily vague in terms of what they want a program to do. For instance, some transportation programs simply say things like, this transportation program should be intended to build roads that connect communities that need connecting. Now, of course, I'm paraphrasing, but there's no mention to say what kinds of criteria, what kinds of requirements, what types of communities or backgrounds within communities should be given preference, or really what merit amounts to. And so when that happens, the executive branch has profound discretion. And I think it's a hard argument to make that the executive branch cannot factor politics into that discretion. Now, whether you think that's how our bureaucracy or how our national funding processes should work, that's one thing. But the reality is there's nothing tying the president's hands. And this is true of Republican presidents, and it's true of Democratic presidents. And so I think at the end of the day, it ends up becoming more of a commentary on a Congress that is just unwilling to do its job. That's true of Democratic Congresses. That's true of Republican Congresses. It's easy to pass continuing resolutions that just essentially say we're going to fund everything at the same level, plus or minus 1%. But it's not getting into the type of oversight role that Congress needs to take, or the legislative role that Congress needs to take to make sure that the executive is not abusing or misusing or stretching or simply administering the law in a way that is inconsistent with Congress's wishes. And so what I think on its face looks like a maybe despicable is too strong of a word, but a practice that's inconsistent with American values, with values such as fairness and equity, is actually something that ends up being perfectly legal under the way that programs are designed. And Daniel had mentioned at the beginning that there are other transparency issues as well for the federal grants process, and that is that at times the merit criteria, the decisions by which grants are judged or rated or scored, ends up being confidential, or it's very hard to get that information through FOIA requests, through lawsuits, or through other means. That's correct. That information is very difficult, the federal government, because of paperwork reduction acts and other efforts in that area, often destroy the materials after a certain number of years. And so going back in a way that, as a social scientist, I like to do, to be able to go back for extensive periods in history so you have better, you can capture statistical analysis and relationships in a more effective and robust way, that's limited by just record-keeping requirements and paperwork requirements. And so that definitely presents a challenge. But politicization goes much deeper than that. And so the way in which an agency designs a program just from scratch, that can have a real impact. It can have real distributional consequences. And so, for instance, if you think about if you have an energy program or you have an agriculture program that focuses on ethanol and grants to producers of products that assist in the production of ethanol, well, that has very serious distributional consequences because not every state can produce those products. And there are a variety of ways in which an administration can design a program in ways that help some states and hurt other states. And then beyond the design of the initial grant program itself, just designing the criteria, what you consider important, what you consider unimportant, that can be targeted in a way that can very much help some states over others. This is true within federal agencies. This is absolutely true in Congress as well. So we have examples of formula grant funding that comes out of Congress that benefits, you know, certain states that have a population this size and federal roads that number in this range of miles and state roads that number in this range of miles and a whole set of criteria that seems to be technocratic on its face, but they're actually just criteria that Robert Byrd wrote that was a really nice way to represent the state of West Virginia and make sure that when you crossed the Pennsylvania border into West Virginia, you went from a really, really bumpy road to one of the most beautiful interstates you'll ever feel in the United States. At least that was until his death. And so there are inside baseball ways in which it makes it even harder for there to be transparency in the grants process because there are so many junctures in federal grants policy where rules can be tweaked in a certain way, and by rules I don't mean regulations in the administrative sense, but just the types of rules governing criteria, assessments, who assesses or who judges grants, and all the way back to the program design itself, and so that makes it very challenging to understand where, when, and to what extent politics enters into a given grant program. And that's why my work tends to focus on more broad-based, systematic, statistical analysis in ways that can look at all grants from a 30,000-foot view and say, well, here are the trends that we know are going on, even if it's hard to jump into individual grant programs or individual agencies and say, well, here are the problem cases and here are the ones that are based on merit. And so that's where statistical analysis helps us. But as I said, getting down to understanding and using the tools of transparency to understand exactly where the problems lie, it ends up being much harder.
Yeah, and I would just quickly follow up on that. Thanks, Dr. Hudak. You know, it's I think there's a lot of things to say. Clearly, independent of the party of the administration, there's incentives to design programs that are going to benefit swing states. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of those intricacies about the program design hold true between administrations so that, you know, if the Department of Agriculture is giving ethanol subsidies, that that may be something that consistently happens independent of the party in power in the White House. I would just say, and I think you'd be happy to articulate this given your book title, I mean, one thing that's true, and we might disagree as to how long this has been going on. I would tend to say that based off some certain data from the Congressional Research Service, that this administration engages in much more executive branch earmarking activity than prior administrations, and I think in large part because they have greater incentives to do that. You have the moratorium on congressional earmarks. You have the stimulus, which are kind of two unique injections of federal power over spending. But I would also just say that even if it was true that only 5 to 10% or even less of federal discretionary spending was actually politicized, while if you call that 5 to 10% earmarks, and recall, you know, this is the same argument people made about congressional earmarks. Well, it's not a big percentage of total outlays. But what we saw with the American people saw with congressional earmarks is the tendency for corruption, the tendency for bridges to nowhere, and all these sorts of things. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw that in the executive branch earmarking context, but also just the fact that it creates incentives that long term may focus more on, you know, who gets what, when, and how versus what is actually the best for a specific discretionary grant program.
Sure. So I'll respond a little bit to your initial points. And so I think given the moratorium on earmarks in Congress, the this administration in particular has had more of an opportunity than others to engage in such behavior. But at the end of the day, what it offers is the administration to have just much more discretion over many more federal dollars. The manner in which they use that discretion varies for sure. And I think the argument that this administration is doing it more than others, my data suggests that is not the case. Although my data carry through to through 2012, and so I can't say, I'm sorry, through 2011, and so I can't say beyond that what the administration, what this administration has been doing. But in its early years, the administration was clearly prioritizing funding in a variety of ways, and defining politicization is crucial here. So you can think of politicization in the way that my book does, in terms of electoral politics, in terms of congressional politics, in terms of gubernatorial politics, seeing where electoral vulnerabilities are, where institutional power rests, where swing states are a factor. But then you can think of politicization in a broader sense, in a way that my book does not look at, and that is simply presidential policy priorities. And so obviously this administration is much more interested in green energy, in environmental regulation, in a whole host of areas that the previous administration was not interested in, or interested in a very different way. And those priorities change from administration to administration, and targeting funds in certain ways to certain efforts, certain ideas, and certain policies. There, an argument can be made there that that's politicization, but an argument can equally be made that that's just simply policy prioritization that an elected official is going to do. What I found, as I said, in my data, at least through 2011, is that this administration is actually quite poor at politicization of funding. I would chalk that up to just the president being largely ineffective as a manager and an administrator, and surrounding himself with people who, in many cases, are just as underqualified or inept in that arena. And so it was hard to find It was very difficult to find politicization, though as 2011 wore on, it seemed like the administration might have been getting it right. In terms of stimulus funding, I found very little evidence of politicization, whether it was in terms of the president helping himself. There was some evidence that he was helping Congress in delivering funds where members of Congress would want them to be delivered, particularly Democrats. But in general, the president's own electoral values, electoral interests, were not being supported by stimulus funds. That is, money flowing to swing states. But surely there can be an argument to be made that within the stimulus bill there were these policy priorities, green energy, high-speed rail, and other policies that definitely reflected the president's interests. Whether those coincided with electoral or political interests or just real policy priorities that he wanted, that's what I think is the story, the large story coming out of stimulus funds, rather than this sort of politicization as we think of it in the traditional sense.
Great. Well, I think we'll take some. Dean, I'll pass the mic to you.
Terrific. Thank you both. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either Dan Epstein or Dr. John Hudak, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who rings in. Let me make a brief commercial announcement. Our teleforum tomorrow, our next scheduled teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll be discussing stealth regulation with law school professor Todd Zwicky and also John D. Graham, who's the former administrator of OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. They're going to be talking about tactics used by agencies to avoid OIRA review and the APA regulatory standards. That's tomorrow at this same number at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Today, if you have a question for our experts on politicization of spending, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller with a question, then our lines are open. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that it's worth investigating this as a new institutional arrangement whereby pork spending is shifted from Congress to the White House or to the administrative agencies controlled by the White House. It simply shifts the public choice problem from electing members of the legislature to electing the president. But it also brings up the problem generally that in any system in which public decisions are made by voting, there will always be a tendency for the candidates that would be elected in any election to try to buy votes. And that perhaps it's time to examine other alternatives to voting, such as a random selection of decision makers in some kind of elaborate jury-like process.
Well, thanks for your question, John. What I would say is I think you're spot on in what you started with in saying that the earmark ban or other rules that will return this power to Congress is simply a transfer of power in terms of who gets to engage in pork. I mean, the idea that the president is engaging in pork barrel politics now is not a reflection of the creation of pork suddenly. It's just a decrease in the amount that Congress engages in this and an increase in the amount that the executive branch engages in this. And so I think that that's right, and it's an important distinction that resolving this, that tying President Obama's hands or whoever the next president is, his or her hands, is simply going to mean that pork continues to exist. It just continues to exist in a congressional sense. And I write about this a little bit in the last chapter of my book, that I think that's a judgment call as to whom you think should have the power of pork, if that's the reform that you want to see. Are they locally elected House members or statewide elected senators, or is it the president who represents everyone? I think those are judgment calls that there are arguments on both sides. But at the end of the day, what I actually found, and it might not be something that's particularly popular with every group or every American, is that what the federal government does have are a lot of bureaucrats who are working hard to make sure that the merit process works. And typically, these politicized processes, as I said, are either happening in the design of criteria and programs, which tends to happen at the appointee level, or it's happening in decision-making itself, which appointees will overrule or usurp bureaucrats. But the irony of all of this is that empowering bureaucrats is actually a fairly effective way to combat against this type of politicization, because it tends to be appointees who are engaging in this practice. And so I've written obviously a bit on this in my book, but also elsewhere, where I write about being in defense of the nameless, faceless bureaucrat, which isn't always, you know, the most popular idea. But there's something to be said about, you know, taking the power out of appointees' hands and out of the hands of the White House and delivering it to those who don't necessarily have as much of a political dog in the fight. Now, that's obviously not always true with every bureaucrat, but it's certainly more likely that a bureaucrat is going to give you a technocratic outcome than the White House is.
I'm interested
in whether or not, Dan Epstein, you agree that it's primarily the appointees who engage in this sort of practice and that they are policed by the bureaucrats. I don't know if you're going to respond there or not.
Yes, I mean, I would say one thing is we have some historical perspective, and there does seem to be a tradition of, at least, I mean, we had the Office of Political Affairs in prior administrations. That office has now been changed. But, you know, historically, the Office of Political Affairs would take a role in not just educating the politicals at the agencies, but educating the procurement officers and the grant officers about the importance of steering funds to certain congressional districts. In fact, I think the whole reason we have the Hatch Act is from the recognition, in at least in terms of the Hatch Act, which is this way of policing impermissible agency political activities. It's very clearly geared towards the technocrats, the day-to-day bureaucrats versus the political appointees. The political appointees can do more politically than the everyday technocrats. And ultimately, Hatch Act enforcement would be zero if the technocrats were less likely to be politically active. Part of the issues are is that they often do get captured. And it may be the case that upon further study, it's because of agency appointees being more aggressive. But as we know, you know, Kathleen Sebelius, former Labor Secretary Hilda Solis, you know, these people were often stumping for the president. They couldn't use their official capacity to do that, but they get a pass in which regular agency employees don't. I would just add one kind of anecdote about that I think supports, you know, John's observation about the politicals. Is you know, there was a major issue several years ago with the Department of Homeland Security where a FOIA officer refused to have the White House review certain responses to a requester from the Associated Press. That decision was overturned by a political at the agency, and the FOIA officer was demoted, which shows that very much, even if we look statistically and we say, well, you know, politicized discretionary spending is a minority of cases. Or we say, look, there's limited opportunities for this kind of political decision-making. And I think, John, in your book, you point out that OMB really, you know, ought to have the biggest way to politicize agencies, but often, from at least in this current administration, it's just not well managed. But I think it's the small examples that have ripple effects that not only shape the culture of agencies. I think this is a problem we see now with the IRS scandal, but it also affects how the public perceives the legitimacy of those institutions.
Again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. At some point earlier, I think it was Dr. Hudak who referred to the Paperwork Reduction Act. It seems to me if you're going to have pork one way or the other, either through Congress or the administrative branch, not branch, but the administrative agencies, that transparency becomes an important aspect of things here. And if I heard you correctly, you mentioned the Paperwork Reduction Act, which I thought was really designed primarily to reduce the paperwork production requirement on citizens, and not really so much the destruction of paperwork by the federal agencies. You mentioned that they were getting rid of documents, which decreased transparency. I guess my question is, in this age, everybody is digitizing all their photos in their entire life and saving it in a digital form. If the government is getting rid of documents under the Paperwork Reduction Act, why aren't they able to digitize them and store them that way?
So I may have misspoken. I know that there are requirements for agencies to hold on to paper paper products involving grants for a certain period of time. That authority may not come from paperwork reduction. My guess is it actually comes from separate regulations which may take authority out of that act or elsewhere. But in many cases, what is happening is particularly for grants that are peer-reviewed or reviewed in a sort of pseudo-peer review process, these people are going to hotels or agencies or conference centers or what, and spending a few days going proposal by proposal, taking notes, filling out forms that are criteria based, however that is defined, and it depends dramatically. There are dramatic differences from agency to agency, program to program, grant to grant, and it's those files that are held onto for only a certain period of time. And so those could be digitized, but I think in an era in which agencies are facing budget cuts, it's going to be very hard to convince an agency to start digitizing things that they don't need to digitize, wasting resources and man hours on doing that, regardless of the benefits to transparency, which obviously, as you suggested, will allow them to hold on to that information for much longer at much cheaper rates in the long term. But in the short term, the digitization of those documents costs money. And it's money that agencies tend not to have. And so I think that's the real challenge that's facing transparency advocates who would want that information preserved either in for more time than it is or in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm. Once again, if you have a question, our phone lines are wide open now. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a question. So let's go to our next caller. Caller might be, you might have muted your own telephone, caller.
I did. I apologize. My name's Carolyn Parlato. I'm curious to know how both or either of you would approach or would advise Congress to actually increase its oversight. How would they do an appropriate oversight to really get a handle on not just this problem, but a lot of problems in the agency which they are not dealing with.
So I'll offer some thoughts. So one is that actually Congress proposed legislation. It came out of the House Oversight Committee, and I think it sat at committee, and it was called the Grant Act. And one of the things that the Grant Act sought to do was any time in which there was a discretionary grant decision where a decision was made that was not based off an even kind of ordinal set of scores. That is to say, if 20 applicants were going to get a grant award and rank number 25 got the award but rank number 23 didn't, the Grant Act would have required a disclosure of that. The whole problem, again, goes into the question of whether this is something that the public is entitled to see. So a lot of universities, in fact, fought back against the Grant Act because the Grant Act would require that the Freedom of Information Act could access applications, it could access scores, it could access evaluations. And universities don't, you know, who are looking for NSF money and other types of money, they don't want their quote-unquote intellectual property being disclosed, even if it shows that, you know, a university in a swing state gets more money and is viewed as a better pick, even if a university out of in a non-swing state is more deserving based off the merit and the project proposal. But I think definitely one thing that you can do is, especially with Congress with its subpoena power, is really try to determine, number one, is do we have a problem with this? I think a lot of the things Dr. Hudak says is there's political benefits to this. So you might have a lot of members of Congress who are happy to delegate a lot of this earmarking to the executive branch, especially if it benefits them. But if there is a need for greater oversight, and if you do have incentives for that oversight, I think a lot of it needs to see, is Congress delegating too much? And are the agencies actually doing things that Congress believes violates merit-based principles? That is to say, that some of this politicization is not in the best interest of the public. It is pure questions of political incentives versus actually doing what are the best projects. And I would just say, lastly, there are potential legislative fixes. You can have more transparency. You can say that agencies can't hide behind this information under the deliberative process privilege, but I think it's very unlikely that Congress actually amends FOIA in a way to increase that kind of transparency and oversight.
So I would echo what Daniel said, Carolyn. I think the best way to do this is to force is not to try to force the administration to make certain efforts or approach grant funding in certain ways, because they're going to do everything they can to continue doing things as they are. The best way is to for Congress to allow the public to see what that deliberative process is like. Increased transparency might be the only way to move this administration or any administration's interest in doing things a little differently. I think the problem in terms of this issue, in terms of getting the type of legislative constituency in place to move the administration in that direction, is that everyone benefits from this system. Presidential earmarks don't just help presidents, they help Congress too. They help members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. As odd as that sounds, the Obama administration is helping Republican congressmen get money for their districts. It happens. And so it's hard for members to work against a system from which they benefit. And of course, then the presidential veto comes into place where it's going to be hard, even if you can get that legislative coalition together, to get the president to sign such legislation, because he enjoys those benefits too. And so that becomes really difficult. In reality, Congress needs to have an honest conversation about what's going on, and I think that's a really hard political argument to make. And so during the earmark ban, where everyone was rushing to ban earmarks, there were very, very few people who were approaching this conversation in a rational way. And one of the people who actually was Senator Inhofe. Senator Inhofe took to the floor and gave a speech that was spot on. And he said, listen, if we give up this power to earmark, whether you find it, and again, I'm paraphrasing him, whether you find it a good or a bad thing, it doesn't stop earmarks. It doesn't shrink the budget. That was the most nonsensical argument that I ever heard in Congress, and this is a Congress that's full of nonsensical talking points, that somehow if we got rid of congressional earmarks, the budget deficit would shrink. Well, the money is still appropriated and authorized. All it did, and Senator Inhofe said this, I quoted it the beginning of one of the chapters of my book, all that does is transfers that power to the White House, to the Obama administration. It doesn't do anything about the level of spending. And so essentially Inhofe's argument was earmarks are going to happen and we should be the ones who are making those earmarks as the elected representatives. No one wants to make that argument because it's not politically popular, but it's consistent, it's sensible, it's smart, but it's one that you're going to get primaried. If you're a Republican, you're going to get primaried for if you make that argument. If you're a Democrat, you're going to get slammed by your Republican opponent for making that argument. So given the competitiveness of elections as they are, either in the primary stage or in the general election stage, it's hard for Congress to make the sensible arguments that they need to make to get that type of spending under control. And I think it's a little easier for Congress to be transparent about their earmarking behavior than it is for hundreds of cabinet agencies to be transparent about theirs.
Looks like we do have three more questions now, so let's try and go to our next caller.
John Rowland again. It seems that this also points to the problem that an entire culture can consist of one or more factions, with one of those factions preferring to go into government work and therefore becoming the bureaucrats. You might remember the old BBC series, Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, which took a humorous look at the problem, but which showed that the bureaucracy tends to become independent of the political branches and that it wouldn't necessarily make any difference who was elected, either at the top or at the legislative level. So that suggests that the only other alternative would be to remove the power to grant money at all from the government, to simply get it out of the business of handing out money.
Well, I'll just make two quick points. One is that you get more accountability through contracts than grants. So I think, right, one perspective is maybe, you know, for things that are currently captured by discretionary grants, we either have Congress step in and have formula grants, which gives Congress more control over the spending, or you just simply say things that are typically done through grants should be applied via contract principles. I'd say the other thing that I kind of hear in your question, John, is, you know, we talk about typically the left will say there's agency capture by special interest groups, but I think at least one observation from the capability of the president to use have presidential pork shows that political interests have also captured the agencies. And it's just something that is another point of studying when we talk about the executive branch, either from a political or a legal perspective.
My response to your question, John, would be that I would be hesitant to suggest that we should get government out of the business of engaging in grants for the sole purpose of the point that I started with, that a lot of times politicization is affecting 5 to 10% of grant allocations in grant dollars. To sort of penalize what is a very merit-based, proper, as we would consider it, proper allocation of funds, which is 90% or better, because of politics in a small percentage of cases, is, I think, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Is it a problem? I think there's a real argument to be made that politicization of grant funds is a problem. But is it something that's happening in every case or most cases? No. And so I think there are a lot of people who depend on grant funds in a variety of ways, and I think you can have a separate intellectual argument about whether government should be in the business of this type of policy, but I don't think it would be proper to have that argument about the propriety of governments engaging in grant allocations in the context of this, because this is not the problem. The problem might be whether about the proper role or size of the federal government, what types of policies are government-oriented. That's an important argument to be had for sure, but I think to suggest that grant dollars should all go out the window because of 5 to 10% of them being politicized, I think that's a much tougher argument to make, and one that would have even less political will in the Congress than trying to get rid of earmarking.
We've still got three questions pending, and we've got to adjourn at 3:00 Eastern time, so just 9 minutes left. I'm going to ask the questioners to be very prompt with their questions, or very concise if possible.
Yes, it seems to me that the bias of our speakers here is that grants are a good thing, but that seems to go counter to the whole conservative libertarian minimalist view of government. He's saying don't throw the grant baby out with the bathwater. Well, the bathwater is the grants, and that's what's one of the things that's driving our budget.
No, I agree. I agree with you completely that essentially in that analogy, the bathwater is the grants. And like I said, there's an important conversation to be had about the role and size of government, about whether government should be engaging in this. But I think that's that problem. If you see that as a problem, if you see the federal government being a grant maker as a problem, that should be something fundamental to grant making and not something that is driven because there's some politicization in the process. I mean, I'm not going to speak for you, but I think your problem, if there's zero politicization in grants, you probably think that the federal government shouldn't be doing it, in the same way that if there was 100% politicization in grants. I think that's a very valid conversation that's a very separate one than the one we're having today.
Okay, two questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Zach Mayo here. It seems to me that a lot of the outrage that might have led to the reduction of legislative earmarking was on sort of the outlier cases, the bridges to nowhere, the extensive funding for West Virginia under Robert Byrd. I jumped on a little bit late, so if these were discussed earlier, then feel free to just shoot it down. But if there has been this shift, is maybe one of the reasons that there might be less overt outrage or attention focused on executive earmarking is that the overall quality of the grants being made, even if they're made for political purposes, they serve the political purposes of the executive, so they might still be disproportionate or ill-fitted to the national scene, but less so, in that they might focus on swing states instead of the needs of Ted Stevens or Robert Byrd.
Yeah, so I would just say clearly, members of Congress, knowing that there is public reaction and outrage about these earmark projects and these pork barrel politics, ultimately say, well, with executive branch earmarks, we can delegate both the accountability and the responsibility to the executive branch, and we can still win and benefit from it. I think Dr. Hudak's research shows members of Congress do benefit from executive branch earmarks, and yet they don't have to take the blame if transparency groups point out that it's a bad system. They can blame it on the executive branch. To the same degree, at least with congressional earmarks, and I'm not an advocate for them, we could see, transparency groups could talk about the ways in which you have wasteful spending or corrupt spending. You can't really easily do that with executive branch earmarks, because a lot of this happens behind closed doors, and the executive branch gets a lot of deference to their internal deliberations, not having to be public.
I think that's spot on. I'd add one more item. I have not, in my research, compared the character or quality of individual earmarks from congressional earmarks to executive branch ones. So I'll be hesitant and careful with what I'm about to say. But I think your premise is correct that the earmarks, at least that got the most attention in Congress, were ones that were considered beyond the pale. The Bridge to Nowhere and other projects like that were ones that seemed to just offend Americans because they seemed so silly. There is the pork book or something that Senator Coburn puts out every year where he talks about some of these projects. Now, some of them, to be fair, are characterized in a way that make them seem silly when they're actually not, and some actually are silly. But what's happening with executive branch earmarks, money is going to swing states and to other areas where there are political needs, but the reality is that need is defined by eligibility for a program far outpaces the amount of assistance that there is to deliver. So in a lot of cases, the administration isn't giving out bridges to nowhere. It's giving out money to people who qualify as needy, but happen to live in states that help the president. And so I think the characterization of these earmarks, at least in the executive branch, might not be as offensive as we think of when we think of the Bridge to Nowhere.
We've got 3 minutes left. Let's try and get this last question in. It seems that our telephone answering service has abandoned us. I'm afraid we're going to have to let that be the final question, but we've got 2 minutes left. Let me give each of you 30 seconds just to wrap up. Dr. John Hudak, any final thoughts?
Sure. First off, thanks everyone for listening today. This has been a really enjoyable conversation. I encourage you, obviously, to think more about the foundations of this topic. It's a really complex topic. It involves the way we think about the size and role of government, about where we think policy should be executed and designed, and the role that a political system has in the production of public policy. And so I think people who jump quickly in this conversation to certain conclusions tend not to think about, as I said, the complexity and the difficulties and the challenges that surround unpacking this issue and getting to the bottom of it and understanding it. And the more we think about how transparency can have multiple effects on these outcomes and to resolve what we consider to be problems, that's the best path forward in terms of, as I said, understanding what is a really big problem, but understanding it in a more holistic way.
Mr. Epstein, a final thought.
Yeah, I would just say I echo a lot of those things. I think ultimately my view is that whenever you delegate more discretion to the executive branch, abuse is something that is bound to happen, especially when you don't have the same checks of accountability for unelected bureaucrats that you do have for elected members of Congress, which is not to say that the ideal is to go back to congressional earmarking, but I think we need to be both as an oversight matter from Congress and as a way of potentially using legal tools to check the executive branch. We have to be concerned that with greater opportunity to politicize, with greater opportunity to have more control over federal spending, that you're going to get typical issues of fraud, waste, and abuse, and perhaps politicization that's not in the best interest of the public. And again, something where the public, even if it's marginal, the public in general is not going to respond well to the idea that their taxpayer dollars are being used for political purposes. And I think that's something where we definitely need to be thinking more critically about this.
Well, my apologies to the caller with the final question. Due to technical difficulties, we just couldn't get there. Our system shut down for some reason. But my thanks to Mr. Daniel Epstein and Dr. John Hudak for their participation today. Also, thanks to the audience for listening and dialing in with your questions. A reminder that tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern time at the same number, we'll be discussing a somewhat related topic, I suppose, stealth regulations. That is how some agencies get past OIRA and the APA in enacting rules and regulations. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern time. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.